in the capital, Tehran. This is news. Thanks for joining us. President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran's presence in the BRICS group of countries is a new step towards establishing justice and lasting peace in the world.
And the benefits of Iran's membership to BRICS is going to make history and open a new chapter and a stronger step towards justice, fairness, ethics, and sustainable and lasting peace on the international stage.
Raisi also said Tehran has a unique capacity for cooperation in the fields of economy and energy. The Iranian president said that Tehran supports the BRICS efforts toward de-dollarization and the use of national currencies. The Iranian president was addressing the BRICS summit in Johannesburg. Tehran has been officially invited to become a member of the BRICS, whose leaders are in South Africa to discuss the bloc's expansion.
We have consensus on the first phase of this expansion process, and other phases will follow. We have decided to invite the Argentine Republic, the Arab Republic of Egypt, the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates to become full members of BRICS. The membership will take effect from the 1st of January 2024.
Ramaphosa was speaking on the third day of the BRICS summit in Johannesburg. The Russian President Vladimir Putin also delivered a video address thanking his South African counterpart for handling the summit and for his efforts to expand the bloc. Chinese president also said the expansion will inject new impetus to the group's cooperation mechanism. The Brazilian president added that the interest of other countries to join the BRICS organization shows the relevance of his pursuit for a new world economic order. Iran, obviously, amongst a host of other countries, has been accepted as one of the members of the BRICS grouping of nations, but we're going to expand more on that with Gisumi Shahmeri, who joins us here in the studios to tell us her familiarity with this, and also for a deeper analysis, Said Mohammad Marandi, university professor and political analyst, also joins us from Tehran. Welcome to you both. So, Gisu, I'll start with you. I had a feeling when I spoke to you when you were with Hossein Amir Abdollahian when he made that visit that Iran would become a member. I think that was one of the questions I asked, which you, I think, shared this similar view. Tell us your familiarity there and, of course, what has developed now inside of Johannesburg.
Exactly. You're absolutely right, Kaveh. By what we saw in that visit of Hossein Amir Abdollahian to Johannesburg, it was pretty obvious that Iran had the necessary support in order to become a BRICS member state. We had talked to people on the sidelines of that meeting, and as I had told you back then when you asked me, this was a very likely move coming from BRICS countries to accept Iran as a full member. Of course, you do know that this is of great significance, particularly because last year the GDP of BRICS countries was even higher than G7. So they are becoming, these countries, this group of countries, which let's note is not an organization just yet, but as soon as it becomes an organization, it will turn into a very significant political organization, and let's not forget that economically speaking, it will have a foothold in today's economy, in the world economy, and also let's not forget that 40% of the people live in BRICS countries. So this means a great deal, considering the fact that I would like to once again remind you what the foreign minister of South Africa back then mentioned in her final statement, the fact that these countries do not recognize unilateral sanctions, particularly unilateral U.S. sanctions, and this is an important issue. They believe that the United Nations has deviated from its correct path and it has to be redirected to towards the purpose that it was once created for. So basically everything that you see happening today, all the events that have been unfolding, are actually history being made.
All right, Mohammad Marandi, let me quote to you what the senior advisor to Iran's president has said. Before we get into your analysis, of course, your reaction to this, where he said permanent members in the group of global emerging economies is considered a historic development and a strategic success for the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic. What do you think?
It is an important event. Iran's membership of BRICS will give it greater access to the decision-making process that has been structured within the organization. Iran will have regular contact with other member states of BRICS. The objective of the states that are members is to create a financial system that is more independent, that cannot be threatened by Western powers, and that is something that the Iranians have been pursuing for a very long time now. The fact that Iran last year was able to become a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, itself a major success, and this year it has become a member of BRICS, will mean, in addition to the fact that it will be at the negotiating table discussing future financial projects, future financial structures and programs that countries will be pursuing collectively, but it also gives an opportunity for world leaders to meet each other much more often. Every year there is a summit for BRICS. Every year there's also a summit for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So through these summits, the Iranian president will be in constant contact with the leaders of India, Brazil, China, Russia, among others, and that will allow these countries also to pursue greater bilateral ties. So there's a strong element of multilateralism involved, especially for Iran, the financial aspect of this, and for the Russians and the Chinese and all those that are threatened by Western financial sanctions. That is very important, but also alongside that, there's a very strong element of bilateral relations that can be pursued on the sidelines of these conferences. So it is a major win for Iran, especially since the United States and its allies have been putting pressure on member states, or some member states, not to have Iran join the organization.
All right, Mohammed Mirandi, when you take a look at the grouping now, which in a sense, at least I was caught by surprise, when you have Iran, Saudi Arabia, the UAE to be part of this, and of course Venezuela has shown intense interest, and you have Russia in addition to China, and looking at the lens of these countries comprise about 40% or even more of the world energy, what type of political leverage does that bring for BRICS altogether when it comes to anything that the West or the U.S. has that perhaps they disagree with? Doesn't that give them some leverage?
Well, natural resources are important. The population of these countries are important. And the economic strength of these countries are all important as well. And so these will all create a greater weight for BRICS to move forward. But I think the most important thing is that BRICS is a sign of the fact that the world is changing and that the global South, Asian countries, African countries, Latin American countries are tired of the status quo, the world order dominated by the West, where they try to dictate terms with control financial institutions, where they wage war whenever they feel they need to wage war, and they impose sanctions on whoever they feel needs to be sanctioned. These countries are obviously tired of that, and all of them in their own way, or almost all of them at least in their own way, have suffered the consequences of Western policies. And so this collective gives them greater strength, greater say, and a greater ability to counter this hegemony, Western hegemony, and to create a more balanced environment in the international community. And that is one reason why so many other countries would like to join. And in future, we will probably see in the coming years other countries joining this community.
Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohammed Mirandi, University Professor and Political Analyst. And Gisu Mishahmedi, a correspondent here in the studio with us. Thank you so much. We'll go to news from the Gaza Strip. The suffering of cancer patients there continues as the Israeli blockade persists, posing a great threat to their lives. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime restricts the entry of medicines and spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza. Ashraf Shannon has more.
Cancer patients in Gaza staged a sit-in protest to condemn the Israeli blockade that has taken its toll on their lives. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before they even can access treatment. Hospitals in Gaza grapple with a severe shortage of medicines, particularly those vital for cancer patients. The journey to receive crucial life-saving medical care is fraught with numerous obstacles for cancer patients in Gaza. Israeli restrictions on freedom of movement have prevented Palestinian patients with serious illnesses from seeking urgent medical treatment beyond the blockaded territory.
Lack of medical equipment and Israeli obstacles are hurting cancer patients. Doctors here are tirelessly working to help us, but the resources are limited. I have throat cancer, and my treatment is not always available in Gaza. I call on all the people around the world to help alleviate our suffering.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer from acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment, experiencing a staggering 60% deficit rate. Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to deteriorate further.
The Israel blockade is the main cause of our suffering. Israel enforces severe restrictions on the entry of medicines and critically needed medical equipment that are essential for treating cancer patients. I have blood cancer and I'm also paralyzed. My life is extremely difficult and I only want to get better.
Israeli authorities also impose a ban on the entry of medical devices and equipment into the Gaza Strip, further weakening the provision of health services to cancer patients.
The worst obstacle facing us is the lack of medicines, especially chemotherapy and radiation therapy supplies for cancer patients. The number of cancer patients in Gaza is very high, and with the current shortages, we can't treat all of them.
The health sector has been grappling with critical shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the Israeli blockade in place since 2007.
Health officials are calling on the international community to help end the shortage of medicines in the besieged Gaza Strip and save the lives of Palestinian patients. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Russian officials have confirmed that the commander of the Wagner Group and his deputy were on board a plane that crashed north of Moscow with no survivors. Russia's Civil Aviation Authority, Rosaviatsiya, said that Evgeny Prigozhin and Dmitry Utkin were among 10 people involved in the crash, including three crew members. The agency said an investigation has been launched into the crash. According to Russian emergency services, the aircraft was traveling from Moscow to St. Petersburg when it crashed. Prigozhin, 62, led an armed mutiny against Russia's military top brass in June. A correspondent in Moscow, Johnny Miller, says investigations into the plane crash may be complicated because many wanted Prigozhin dead.
Let's give you some of the background, of course, of this. Prigozhin, the head of private military group Wagner, very powerful until recently, doing a lot of the fighting in Ukraine. During the Battle of Barmet, which Wagner were eventually successful of, Prigozhin started to make some rather wild statements on camera, showing himself in front of dead Wagner soldiers, even at one point criticizing or questioning Ukrainian war crimes in Donbass, and crucially challenging the Russian military or Ministry of Defense. He then, of course, led that mad march to Moscow, 8,000 or so Wagner troops heading to Moscow, many calling it an attempted coup. On the way, they shot down Russian military planes, leading to the death of 12 Russian soldiers. So a very serious and shocking event. That was 2 months ago. And now we have this event, another shocking and dramatic event of this war. What happened? The investigation is currently underway. Was it a missile? Was it a bomb? It's unlikely to have been an accident. And then who did it? Many are speculating, perhaps those in Russia. Prigozhin had many people, frankly, who would want him dead, perhaps NATO countries, Ukraine. So we'll have to wait and see what happens in an investigation, but many will have already made up their mind with who did it and why.
Japan has started releasing treated radioactive water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. The move has drawn strong criticism from China, which has slammed the discharge of wastewater as extremely selfish and irresponsible. Beijing has also suspended imports of all aquatic products from Japan, citing food safety concerns. Meanwhile, a protest has been held in South Korea over Japan's move. Police arrested at least 14 people trying to enter the Japanese embassy in Seoul. The move to release wastewater into the Pacific Ocean was approved 2 years ago by the Japanese government and green-lighted by the UN nuclear watchdog last month. The discharge is a key step in the process of decommissioning the Fukushima nuclear facility after it was destroyed by a tsunami. The U.S., Japan, and South Korea have agreed to expand cooperation against threats in the Indo-Pacific. The trilateral agreement made in a summit on Friday has drawn criticism. South Korean NGOs suggest that Washington is further provoking military tensions. Our correspondent Frank Smith has more from Seoul.
South Korea kicked off yet another round of large-scale military exercises with the U.S. by conducting Air Force drills early this week. South Korea says the joint drills are based on an all-out war scenario and will involve field training and command post exercises and address cyber threats and terrorism. The drills follow the recently concluded trilateral summit with Japan at Camp David, where President Biden warned the DPRK and other countries.
We're doubling down on information sharing, including on the DPRK's missile launches and cyber activities, strengthening our ballistic missile defense cooperation. And critically, we've all committed to swiftly consult with each other in response to threats to any one of our countries from whatever source it occurs.
The joint U.S.-South Korea drills under President Yoon actually lead to a decline in national security, say some NGO leaders. The DPRK has indicated it will launch a satellite in the coming days as it seeks to bolster its surveillance activities.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has reversed course in much of the country's foreign policy. Engagement with the DPRK has been replaced with confrontation. And while U.S. President Biden praises President Yoon for his political courage, many South Koreans oppose his policies.
Trilateral cooperation with Japan is particularly touchy in South Korea for historical reasons, and opposition to the Fukushima nuclear contaminated water release further damaged sentiment toward Japan. Frank Smith, Seoul.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
According to the data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, annual private rental prices surged by 5.2% in England, 6.5% in Wales, and 5.7% in Scotland. Within England, the highest annual percentage change in private rental prices was in the West Midlands, Yorkshire, and the Humber, and London at 5.5%, while the Northeast saw the lowest increase at 4.6%. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, private rental prices paid by tenants in the UK have jumped by 5.3% in the 12 months leading up to July, marking the largest annual percentage change since records began in 2016. Data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, has shown. The figure was up from 5.2% in the previous month, with costs consistently increasing over the past 2 years. According to the ONS, annual private rental prices surged by 5.2% in England, 6.5% in Wales, and 5.7% in Scotland. Within England, the highest annual percentage change in private rental prices was in the West Midlands, Yorkshire and the Humber, and London at 5.5%, while the North East saw the lowest increase at 4.6%. The ONS figures also showed house price growth slowing, rising 1.7% in the 12 months to June, down from 1.8% increase in May and well below the peak of 14% in July last year. According to the report, the average house price in the UK was £288,000 in June. Average house prices increased over the year by 1.9% to $391,000 in England, by 0.6% to $272,000 in Wales, and by 2.7% to $222,000 in Northern Ireland. House prices in Scotland stayed practically unchanged at an average of $241,000. The head of housing market indices at the ONS, Ami North, said annual house price inflation measured using final transaction prices slowed again in June, but the fall was gentler than we have seen in previous months. The British housing market saw mortgage rates hitting a 15-year high last month due to a series of interest rate hikes by the Bank of England to curb inflation, which has sent demand plummeting. A key mortgage rate in the UK surged to its highest level in 15 years recently, exceeding the rate reached in the aftermath of a September mini-budget crisis. And that is according to figures from data provider Moneyfacts. The average two-year fixed residential mortgage rate jumped to 6.66% recently, narrowly exceeding the 6.65% touched last October. Mortgage costs in Britain are now at their highest since August 2008 during the financial crisis, when rates stood at 6.94%. The British housing market has slowed as soaring mortgage rates, driven by a series of interest rate hikes by the Bank of England to curb inflation, have sent demand plummeting. Concerns about a stickier-than-expected consumer price growth, which held at 8.7% in May, have led to a significant increase in the cost of funding, with fixed mortgage deal rates climbing in recent weeks. On top of the strains on the country's ailing housing market, the rate surge is sparking fears of a catastrophe for cash-strapped homeowners. Andrew Ossam, home director at Lloyds Banking Group, was quoted by Reuters as saying, "Undoubtedly, households and customers are feeling the effect of not just mortgage rates increasing, but the wider cost of living crisis." The BOE's latest rate hike of 0.5 percentage points to 5% would see 1.2 million British households, equivalent to 4% nationwide, run out of savings by the end of the year because of higher mortgage repayments, a study by the National Institute of Economic and Social Research showed. Matthew Ryan, head of market strategy at global financial services firm Ebori, said, "We suspect that higher mortgage rates will contribute to weaker economic activity in early 2024, and we are now not ruling out a technical recession in the first half of next year." He added that financial markets were pricing in a peak in UK interest rates of around 6.35% in the first quarter of 2024. According to Guardian, the average cost of renting a room in the UK has risen to more than £700 a month for the first time, according to data from the property website Spare Room. Experts said the data was proof of the housing market, that this market isn't working for anyone, and that rising rents meant tenants were stuck in unsuitable homes. The data from one of the UK's largest home-sharing websites shows that in the second quarter of this year, the average monthly cost of a room was £704, 17% higher than in the same period of 2022. The largest regional increases were in Northern Ireland, up by 20% year-on-year, closely followed by London and Scotland, both up by 19%. The Spare Room's data showed rents had increased year-on-year in all the UK's 50 largest cities and towns, with the biggest rises in Edinburgh, up 25%, Middlesbrough, 21%, and Manchester, 20%. In London, room rents reached an average of £971 a month. This figure reflects rooms advertised via Spare Room that are typically in shared homes. They are in line with other surveys in recent months that have highlighted how sizable the rent rises are given the shortage of properties. The chief executive of Generation Rent, Benny Taumi, said rising rents on new tenancies mean renters face compromises like squeezing into smaller homes or moving further away from workplaces and family. He added that the dramatic rental rises also meant people were stuck in unsuitable homes that they can afford but would like to leave. In May, the estate agents Hamptons said the average new monthly rent outside London had passed £1,000 for the first time, and that tenants in Great Britain were typically paying 25% more than the start of COVID-19. Matt Hutchinson, a Spare Rooms director, said the housing market simply isn't working for anyone. Renters and homeowners are struggling, and landlords are continuing to leave the market. He added that although rents in London remained high, they had fallen slightly in June, the first time rents have decreased in capital in over a year, Hutchinson said. Nevertheless, for many people, housing will be the key issue for the next general election, so we need to hear something positive and practical from all parties in the coming months. Sticking plaster policies isn't enough. We need real commitment to fixing this housing crisis.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
It was on the journey to Karbala where Imam Hussein alayhi salam is riding his horse along with his family and his companions. And for a moment, he sees a vision in which he hears a cry, and the cry says to him that you are people who are speeding ahead, but death is coming and chasing you, and you are making your way towards Jannah. You're making your way towards paradise. And when the Imam alayhi salam wakes up, he knows that this is an indication that it is only a matter of time before he will be leaving this world. So he cries out, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." Now Ali Akbar alayhi salam was the son of the Imam, and he was always close to his father. And when he hears his father cry this cry, he comes to him and he says, "My father, what is wrong?" And the Imam alayhi salam asks him, he narrates to him, you know, the dream or the vision that he had. And then Ali Akbar alayhi salam has a question for his father. He says that, "Afalasna ala al-haq," are we not on the path of the truth? And the Imam alayhi salam says that, "Yes, indeed, by the one who to whom all of us will return." And then Ali Akbar alayhi salam says that famous line, "Idhan la nubali bil maut." If that's the case, then it is not a concern for us that we should have to die. Now at this point, Imam Hussein alayhi salam says something which is very interesting. He doesn't just leave it at that. He doesn't just say that, okay, I agree, and mashallah. What does he say? He says, "May Allah reward you. The best reward that a son can get on account of his relationship with his father." What does that show us, brothers and sisters? It shows us that Ali Akbar alayhi salam didn't just become Ali Akbar just like that. Ali Akbar alayhi salam has a history of a relationship with his father. And at this time, after spending all these years, he has reached the prime of his youth. He's being tested in a way that perhaps no other youth has been tested before. And Imam Hussein alayhi salam is seeing the fruits of this labor. He's seeing the perfect manifestation of what he wants in a son. And then he says that may Allah reward you the best reward that a son can get on account of his relationship with his father. It's this relationship that, inshallah, I want to talk about today. Now remember that we have other examples of relationships. Yesterday we talked about Abdullah, the son of Zubair, and how he was able to control his father, how he was able to manipulate him. Abdullah was somebody who apparently he grew up in a broken home. His father apparently did not take the right strategy when it comes to parenting. And Abdullah's actions were so instrumental in turning history towards darkness and oppression of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. There was one time where the mother of the believers, you know, the wife of the Prophet, that she, on the way to the Battle of Jamal, she hears the sound of the barking dogs. It's a very interesting, she hears the sound of barking dogs. And she asks, that what is this place right here? And they tell her that it is the place of the water of Ho'ab. And when she hears this, she cries out, "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un." And she says, "Rudduni, rudduni, send me back, send me back. I'm not going forward." So they ask her why. She says that when I heard the dogs barking, it reminded me of an incident that happened many years ago. When the beloved Prophet, when he had all of us gathered and he told us that, and he told his wives, he said that beware of that incident when the dogs will be barking at the place of water of Ho'ab. And then he turned to me specifically, he told me that you don't be the one who is in that situation. And I realized that at that time he was predicting what's going to happen right now. So it was going to be over. The first civil war in history was going to be stopped at that point. But who is it that becomes that reason for why this civil war continues? It's Abdullah ibn Zubair. And he comes up and he says, "What's the matter?" She says, "What happened?" He says, "Who told you this is the place of the watering of Ho'ab. She said, that person. He says, okay. He brings 50 people and he has them testify that the place we're in is not Ma'ul Ho'ab, it's some other place. And after that, she's convinced. And they say, you know, Muslim historians from all schools of thought, they say that the first time in Islamic history that somebody actually took an oath on a lie in this manner was Abdullah ibn Zubayr. He turned history against the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. So, how do we form this relationship with our children? What is the Islamic basis? What are the Islamic guidelines for this? One of our great scholars, Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, may Allah protect him, he has a beautiful analogy. He says that a family is not made up of individuals who just happen to be in the same location at the same time. He says that, for example, if you want to build a building, because after all, we said yesterday, we quoted the hadith that says that marriage, family is a building. He says if you want to build a building out of bricks, you don't just get bricks and stack them up, and there you go, you have your home or your building. You can get the best bricks, the highest quality. You know, you can import them from, I don't know, Turkey and get all this nice colors and everything like that. But that itself is not going to build your building. That is the weakest of buildings. Because bricks alone do not make up a building. If you want to have bricks, you have to have something else, which is called mortar, which is that substance which binds the bricks together. Without that mortar, these bricks will just fall apart. What is that mortar? That mortar is the connection that makes us not just be individuals, but rather makes us be a single unit. It's that connection of compassion and love. Now, brothers and sisters, in the modern world, unfortunately, there's many aspects of it which try to rip apart these stitchings and rip us apart and make us into individuals. We're in a world right now which is an individualistic world where people, for the most part, are on their own and they have to fend for their own and face life's difficulties all on their own. Sometimes even within their home and their marriage, they don't have the support that they need. If you have parents who are trying to connect to you, if they're trying to come and make contact with you and discuss with you and talk to you, if they're interested in your life, which they should be, if they want to take you out, which they should, please do not be somebody who says that I'm okay. I'm fine with my phone and my friends and my social media. Because all those will not be there for you when you really need them to. And your parents will bend their backs backward. They'll sacrifice their own life to make sure that you're happy. This is what the type of values that we learn from Karbala, that if it comes to family, we will never abandon each other. Even when the times are dire, we're all going to be together. We don't have a single example of one of the family members saying that, Dad, Mom, I'm okay. I'm going to do things on my own here. No, they're in it together. And that comes about by wanting to have that connection.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن صلى الله عليه.
choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Today, millions of Americans remain disenfranchised and denied access to the most basic freedoms taken for granted by others, simply because of their race. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out noted, disparities between black and white Americans persist in employment, wages, health care, voting rights, sentencing and incarceration, housing, and the building of intergenerational wealth. Jennifer Jones Austin, executive director of the Federation of Protestant Welfare Agencies, FPWA, a century-old group with deep ties to the civil rights movement, said racial inequality is still recorded across nearly all measures of well-being in the U.S. today. Today, millions of Americans remain disenfranchised and denied access to the most basic freedoms taken for granted by others simply because of their race. Black Americans earn 20% less than their white counterparts, even with identical college degrees. This racial wealth gap has long-term detrimental impacts on families. One in three black children live in poverty, compared to less than one in 10 white children. On the surface, many of the policies and legal structures that maintain inequality have little to do with the anti-woke culture wars Republicans obsess over, especially now that the likes of DeSantis and Donald Trump have weaponized white backlash to the uprising against systematic racism and police violence that swelled in 2020. The movement for Black Lives harkens back to the 1960s, when images of police brutality in the Deep South fueled civil rights protests, and white conservatives responded to calls for desegregation with racist frenzy and banter about the state's rights. The painting of today's black and intersectional activists as anti-American and the banning of their ideas and identities in the classroom comes right out of an old right-wing playbook, creating a convenient distraction from long-standing pillars of white supremacy. A prime example, jobs and minimum wage, an issue as salient today as it was when black workers marched in 1963 to demand jobs with dignity and fair pay. Adjusted for inflation, today's federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour has less earning power than the $1.25 minimum in 1963. In fact, the minimum wage is worth less today than any time since 1956, thanks to congressional inaction by both Democrats and Republicans. Employment discrimination and underfunded K-12 schools help explain why black workers tend to be concentrated in lower-wage industries, disproportionately exposing black families to the rock-bottom federal wage floor maintained by Congress and red state legislatures. Indeed, black sanitation workers are still organizing for better wages and working conditions decades after the Memphis sanitation strike of 1968. Martin Luther King was assassinated shortly after rallying with the striking workers. Even as black people earn college degrees at significantly higher rates today, on average, they continue to face higher unemployment and lower wages than their white counterparts across all ages and educational levels, according to the report. The average black college graduate owes $25,000 more in student loan debt than their average white counterpart due to lower levels of pay for the same work, which exacerbates the wealth gap. This wealth gap between white and non-white workers remains stubbornly wide as a result, even as the wage parity improved somewhat since 1963. The median annual income among white women with college degree is 19% higher than black women with college degrees. On average, black and brown women earn $0.65 and $0.55 for every $1 earned by white men, respectively. Today, black and Latino men are concentrated in low-wage jobs more than any other group. Then there is racist policing and the U.S. system of mass incarceration, a nexus of discrimination and institutionalized violence that many activists remain committed to abolishing 3 years after 2020 uprisings. This system has been upheld by both Republicans as well as Democrats. According to reports, in most major cities, Democratic leaders ignore widespread calls to divest from police departments and local jails and invest instead in schools, parks, healthcare, and social services to build safety in communities suffering from divestment and targeted law enforcement. As a result, black and Latino men are still disproportionately incarcerated for drugs, and black men without high school diplomas are 3 times more likely to be incarcerated than their white counterparts, according to the reports. For incarceration rates, the disparity is yet more severe. 1 of 3 black boys born today can expect to be sentenced to prison in their lifetime versus 1 out of 17 for their white peers, Jones Austin said, adding, "We need more aggressive policy change." Race and identity may be flashpoints in today's partisan politics in the United States, but the policies that shape racial disparities were supported by leaders in both parties, Democrats and Republicans. From decades of attacks on organized labor and neoliberal trade deals that offshored jobs in 1990s and 2000s, to the disastrous war on drugs and racist sentencing laws that filled prisons with black and brown people, both Democrats and Republicans have supported and upheld the building blocks of systematic racism. Meanwhile, Washington Times reported cities with higher numbers of black residents and more segregated neighborhoods are more likely to have mass shootings due to the effects of structural racism in the United States. And that's according to a new study. 10 researchers published a study recently in JAMA Surgery. They examined 865 mass shootings that killed 828 people and wounded 3,968 across the U.S. 51 largest metro areas from 2015 to 2019, as recorded in population-based data and the Gun Violence Archive. The study found that cities with higher percentages of black residents, higher instances of black-white neighborhood segregation, higher violent crime rates, and more single-parent black families were more likely to be affected by mass shootings, which the researchers defined as incidents that killed or wounded at least four people. The FBI also uses that definition to track the crimes.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commanders, crew, and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. Another important thing is believing in yourself and having confidence, and other important factors. Effective management that is accompanied by skill is another factor. Capable, efficient, skilled management is also very important. This is the front line of the operation. Behind the scene, the formation of the strategic headquarters that I mentioned and the continuous communication between the commander and army officials with the crew moving on the seas was also a very important part of the story. As was mentioned in the reports, I didn't write it down. I believe that about 80 meetings, for example, have been held in that center over the past few months. All of these things are deserving of praise. They are important. This is one part of the importance of your job, which, as I will speak about later, must be explained to others. There are ways to do this, which I will briefly mention.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another issue is the role that families play. The Honorable Lady, a spouse of one of the crew members who spoke at the beginning of the meeting, mentioned some matters, but it is more than that. These feelings of concern are not an insignificant matter. Your loved one is at sea for 8 months. You are worried. You miss them. And you don't know what to tell your children. Parents have been patient in one way and spouses in another way. They endured this, and they felt proud. When I saw the television footage of the families of the sailors when the flotilla returned to our shores, I could sense the feeling of pride in their wives and parents. This feeling of pride is very important. It motivates both you and others to accomplish these kinds of great tasks. If the families had nagged and complained, if they had expressed discontent and displeasure, those who had gone would have felt regret. Thank God your families passed this test well. They were very patient. They felt proud and they showed this pride. I feel it necessary right here and now to remember and bow in respect to the families of our dear martyrs. Thank God your loved ones returned to you. You have been able to see them and hold them in your arms.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth.